and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that. Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl. Well, I'm a screen guy.
Oh, Pennsylvania, we love Pennsylvania.
As we continue to frame what happened in the 2020 elections, our guest today, Eliza Griswold, is going to help us get into the mindset of suburban women voters and families that have lived for generations in Southwest PA. You know, for generations, her family can trace its roots back in Southeast PA to the Revolutionary War. And speaking of war and conflict, Eliza has reported for international publications from conflict zones in Nigeria and in Pakistan. But germane to our discussion, she spent 7 years living and reporting from Washington County on the West Virginia border south of Pittsburgh. And she knows all about county fairs. She knows about the evolution of the natural gas industry. And I encourage each of you to read her excellent work in The New Yorker, both in 2018 and certainly this past cycle. And if you haven't already, do yourself a favor, pick up her Pulitzer Prize winning book entitled Amity and Prosperity. It'll allow you to plunge deeper into the bedrock of the Marcellus Shale and understand the changes in PA politics over the last decade, brought about in part by the development of the natural gas industry. So Eliza, pull up a chair. Welcome to my kitchen table.
Let me be clear. No matter how many lies he tells, I am not banning fracking.
The latest CBS News Battleground Tracker shows Joe Biden is still ahead in the key state of Pennsylvania.
You yourself said on multiple occasions when you were running for president that you would ban fracking.
Joe Biden will not ban fracking. That is a fact.
Ari, thank you so much for having me.
Quite curious to ask, because it just seems like such a unique trajectory, from Princeton to Pakistan to Pennsylvania, I mean, literally war zones to Washington County. That's just not normal. How did that happen over the last two decades or so?
Oh, goodness. That is a hard one. You know, I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and I was a PK, a pastor's kid, in a progressive household. And every dinner we would sit around like with stinky monks or like religious nut jobs of some kind or the other, listening to how different people made sense of the world. And I think that idea that there was value in like ideological difference wasn't threatening, right? It was informative. Growing up that way, you know, I became a journalist just before 9/11. I was freelance the morning of the attacks. I had done my first story for the London Sunday Times magazine in the Middle East. And that morning, I was in Central Park walking with my sister. And when we realized what had happened, I just called the London Sunday Times and became a stringer down at the World Trade Center for the next couple of weeks. And then they sent me to Pakistan. And that was really it. You know, I mean, I was in the same sneakers from the World Trade Center to like the Taliban camps. And I really never looked back. And I'm part of an entire generation of really longtime independent journalists who were made in that experience. But what I really saw at play there was so little understanding of the role that ideology played in global conflict. And we all thought it was a matter of political economy. Well, the haves and have-nots, you know, these people don't have any money, they don't have any education, and so they're violent. And not only did that not bear up with the bin Laden family, it just took religion in particular and put it on the sidelines in a way that it couldn't be sidelined. So I spent, for my first book, I spent 7 years traveling in Asia and Africa, looking at what happens when Christians and Muslims come into violent contact, fighting over everything from water to land to electricity. And then after that, there's no American who can go abroad and look at the problems there and not feel a responsibility to see the exact same things here in America. And That happened for me in Nigeria. There had been a bridge collapse and a couple of people killed in 2013. And it was the same. It was just after the bridge in Minneapolis. Do you remember that I-35W collapsed and killed 13 people? And I realized then that like the idea of what we now call American exceptionalism, right, was crumbling fast. So I came back to the US to look at how our infrastructure, how we don't invest in it, how our lifeline systems are crumbling. And that took me to southwestern Pennsylvania because of the sheer number of structurally deficient bridges, right, around Pittsburgh because of climate change and post-industrial life. And as soon as I started looking at infrastructure in Pennsylvania in 2013, it was impossible to look at infrastructure and not look at fracking with a massive influx of trucks, pipelines, and how that affected people's lives and how, much like Nigeria, people who had the least were living on land richest in natural resources and how they interacted with companies and, again, how ideology came to play there. So that's what really interests me, how people living next door to one another can believe in different things to the point they're willing to die for them.
I had never heard of the term PK. I need to share that I'm an RK, a rabbi's kid. But, you know, it's not just the roads, right? I mean, and the bridges, it's also the locks and dams, which there's certainly quite a few as you make your way into southwest Pennsylvania. But wow, that's a whirlwind. So you land more or less there in southwest Pennsylvania. My understanding is you land literally in a Hilton Garden Inn, which I've stayed in many times. I think I know the owners of it as well. Did you know that was going to be a 7-year journey?
No way. If I ever understood these projects would be as long and as challenging as they are, I wouldn't take them on. I was actually looking exactly at locks and levees and dams. One day I went out to look at this 100-year-old crumbling dam, crumbling lock with a woman, an amazing character in southwestern Pennsylvania named Rose Riley, who is like the Rachel Carson of, because she's modest too. She's not out there. She's not an activist. She's a quiet biologist who's been looking at water quality for the past 3 decades. She took me out to look at some locks. And then she said to me, you know, I'm headed down to Morgantown, to West Virginia, to listen to people who are affected by this new thing, this fracking, farmers, you know, people who want to talk about their watersheds. Would you come? And I said, I'd love to come. And on the way, that hour-long trip from Pittsburgh down to Morgantown is like watching extraction written into the landscape, right? You see mountains that are flat-topped. It's like, well, that's mountaintop removal. Places where the highway has crumbled because of mine subsidence underneath it. So what this really feeds, what I don't think bubble people, which I certainly understand and live among, get, is the way in which many rural Americans feel that they have paid for America's energy costs for centuries. And part of this resentment and disenfranchisement has to do with what they see as the hypocrisy of the bubble, where you guys have taken these resources and you've shamed us about the dirty practices that we engage in to get them to you. And that really, really interests me.
I hadn't heard that term in the bubble, so to speak. And it's such a stark divide nowadays in America between rural and then urban and then certainly suburban. What was the biggest surprise, if you can think back? I guess now that's over 8 years ago, but as you were getting settled there in Washington County, you know, it's only about an hour distance, 35, 40 some miles south of Pittsburgh, but in many regards, kind of a world away. What was the biggest surprise for you?
The biggest surprise in how people lived was their water, which my 7-year-old makes fun of me for saying water, which I don't even hear. But as a Philly girl, that's how I say it. But
I got to interject, by the way. I just learned I'm catching up on reading. My New Year's resolution is reading for pleasure. But arguably, the FBI special agent who captured the Unabomber going back, 1995-ish, it was a Ben Salem, Bucks County beat officer. And he perfected or originated something called forensic linguistics.
Huh.
And it was exactly what you just said about water. I don't know if I say it the same way. I'm from Allentown, as you know, but encourage you and encourage all listeners to get to know a real, real American hero who gave his life to the Bureau and took down the Unabomber.
That's amazing. I mean,
but I'm sorry I cut you off.
No, not at all. I just have to say, I think, so the most shocking thing to me was that people didn't have access to drinking water. And I couldn't believe it. Like, I couldn't get my head around it because they hauled water. They didn't have what they call city water, right? and how that worked in practical ways in the towns of Amity and Prosperity, where I spent most of my time, was that some people had wells, if they could afford to dig that low into the aquifer. But all of this extraction, plus the weird geography there that makes it so rich in fossil fuels, made it so that sometimes it was too expensive to dig a well. And if people didn't have city water, which they didn't, they had to go to the local water station. Rough Creek was the name of the water station nearest to Amity. They had to have a pickup truck. Buying the water wasn't that expensive. That wasn't their primary cost. It was the gas, the truck, the water buffalo. And to see that people lived this way, right, in at that time in 2013, and then they sit in their houses and they watch 10,000 gallon water trucks drive right past, right? And they don't have water to bathe. That gap just explains so, so much to me. And that was shocking. But I think what was the biggest revelation for me in terms of understanding history and the relationship between liberal elites and rural people in Pennsylvania was I went out to a farm one day to a farmer who has since passed away, and he asked me where I was from. And I knew that saying to him I was from New York City was going to be a bad answer, but I assumed that Philadelphia would be a good one, right? So I said to him, well, I live in New York City, but I'm from Philadelphia. And he said, that's two strikes against you, right? I was like, well, that's convenient thinking. And then I went and did some work, right? And to understand how the Quaker elite in Philadelphia basically outsourced war, right, to newly arrived poor European settlers, sent them out to, you know, the Western boundary, had them, didn't give them any land, made them fight Native Americans so that the Quakers didn't get their hands bloodied. And my family dates back to that. We have been, until my grandmother died, we'd lived on the same land since before the Revolutionary War. We've lived on that same land since, I guess, George Washington sheltered troops there at a place called Camp Woods. And all of this history has come to me through this sense of moral, like on the right side of history, when in fact, to see the hypocrisy in that history is to own some of our part in what this divide looks like now.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'll admit I got to study up on my early American history, but I mean, this was where George Washington kind of made a name for himself in the French and Indian War, and then was really tested, and the early government was tested for the Republic with the Whiskey Rebellion.
Man, you cannot. The Whiskey Rebellion is like the Capitol riots, you know, in his. I mean, it is right. It's crazy to see. So the Whiskey Rebellion, right, being the first time you had Revolutionary War veterans, they had been paid in script paper that they had no other salary. They get back to their little farms. Native Americans had come and raided those farms and burnt down homesteads while they were off fighting. They had to rebuild from scratch. Suddenly, they learn they're not going to get paid their salaries from the Revolutionary War. They have one cash product. The most valuable thing that they barter is whiskey. It's a lot cheaper carrying it over, you know, the Allegheny Mountains as whiskey than it is as any kind of grain, right? So what happens is Alexander Hamilton, who is the most notorious villain in southwestern Pennsylvania, right? I mean, you want to talk about the way that the bubble versus like the rest of America sees Alexander Hamilton. That's a great example. His portrait is hanging upside down in the window of Main Street Store, a whiskey distillery in Washington, Pennsylvania. So Alexander Hamilton decides to tax these war veterans, and they rise up against this first federal tax. They tar and feather tax collectors. George Washington, for the first time in history, sends federal troops against our own people. And to this day, that idea of the federal government is hostile to us, is trying to take what's ours and give us nothing, is both a construct and a felt reality for many people living in that part of the state.
So let's go, you know, in the time machine, we're coming back to the 21st century. This term fracking, some people don't like the term shale gas development, others might say hydraulic fracturing, others might say, I mean, it seems like this is one of the issues that dominated the 2020 election. The primaries on the debate stage in the final 100 days, now President Biden having to do multiple campaign stops and incorporate it into his talking points. I mean, what is it, do you think, about this? I mean, we're doing this. Our electricity now is powered by natural gas. It's allowing us to do this, and it's displaced coal, which there certainly also is a lot of in Southwest PA. You know, I don't remember coal being as much of a contentious issue in previous presidential campaigns, but something about fracking, this four letter plus three word, just really seems to have been a lightning rod.
For so many reasons. And you're exactly right, Ari. Fracking is an ideological football, right? It's a term that no one really understands and everybody throws around. And basically it breaks down to like, the more progressive you are, the more opposed to it you're going to be ideologically. What I did was try to set out and write a non-ideological lived experience book about what it means to live in proximity to fracking. And what I would say is there's so much disinformation and misinformation about fracking. And the most important thing I probably learned just to write at large is both left and right do a disservice in seeing fracking as like this 2-week period in which we go deep in the shale and we crack up. I mean, I'm not going to waste our time describing what fracking is, but like we crack ancient seabeds. And basically, you know what fossil fuel is? It's poo. It's not even the dead bodies of like old sharks. It's their poo. So like sucking ancient poo out of the earth, that's fracking. Okay. But around it is basically, it's like building a 100-story apartment building 800 feet from somebody's house. So many of the problems that are related to fracking are truck traffic, construction, right? And I feel like if we could return the discussion to that, as opposed to this, like what happens a mile down in the earth, we could put more practical regulations in place. I believe that the misunderstanding, I don't believe this, this is what I've reported, that Obama, and this is another ideological misunderstanding, like the left will be like, oh, Trump and fracking. Let's look at Obama. Obama was pro natural gas development. And he believed natural gas was the bridge to renewables. And the truth is, it was a bridge to nowhere. We don't need fracking to get to renewables. It's basically a way in which Wall Street has set up a shell game, which I could break down to you, or I could just tell you to read Bethany McLean's Saudi America, which is like how the 2008 financial crisis basically propped up these companies with funny money, and they're profitable only on their balance sheets, but not by they get gas out of the ground, which they lose money on these wells. So 2 miles and 30 years of oil and gas development in 90 seconds. It's like drunk history of fracking I just gave you.
Well, I'm not an engineer and I don't own any land that, as far as I know, has natural gas under it. So I'm sure listeners might have different opinions, but I'll leave that to others. Let me ask you, when you take a look at Washington County and everything that's happened over recent decades, what do you see is what's the census going to yield? What's the next decade, let alone the next generation yield for Washington County? And for that matter, so many counties across Pennsylvania.
That's such a great question, Ari. And as a journalist, not a prognosticator, I can't predict the future. I can only report on what's happening. So I wish I could answer that in any way that made sense. I mean, I know what you know in terms of what we are so grateful to Chris Borick for tracing, right? Which is basically statistically what's happening county by county in Pennsylvania in terms of what's shifting blue and what's shifting red, right? And although we are seeing these major shifts, and it's like, well, what's going to happen in Pennsylvania? These areas are turning more red. These areas are turning more blue. Thanks to Chris's careful work, it's very clear that the areas that are turning blue in the state are the areas where population is growing. And so for that reason, if trends continue, we will see a bluing of Pennsylvania. I think what I have seen through the midterms to now is a level of political engagement among women that is, I don't have the ancient history in Pennsylvania to know whether it's new, but it feels extremely engaged to me. Like just watching suburban women, some of whom voted for Trump in 2016, not only change their vote, but become engaged in politics on a level, on a grassroots level, that's actually really exciting. That's been really fun for me to see firsthand.
I don't know, as a journalist, I'm not a journalist, if you come up with the titles or the headlines or your editors do, but I'm going to give you the credit. In 2018, you had a great piece, really well reported, like all of yours, but the title was A Swing Voter Swings. And as I recall, it profiled a school psychologist about my age from Chester County, a lifelong registered Republican, grew up in a Republican household, and something clicked on or before the 2018 midterm elections. And she said, not only am I going to vote, but what did she tell you? And to that point, you know, what What is it about the suburbs? Are they a bridge to the rural America, or is it just a continuation of the bubble? I just found it a fascinating piece and encourage all listeners to check it out.
Thank you. I mean, no, I think the suburbs are their own entities. They're an extension of the bubble, I would say. But what is exciting about so many of the suburbs around Philadelphia and that level of political engagement, first of all, it's around pipelines, right? What has engaged many of these suburban women is there have been these oil and gas, these liquid natural gas pipelines, which are like highly explosive and almost unregulated, have been coming through their backyards. I'll be honest, I don't hear a lot of love for candidates. They're not like Joe Biden is the answer to anything, right? More of them who are politically engaged are Bernie folk. But it is this level of oil and gas development in Pennsylvania and the idea that, yes, environmental, but more the idea that companies could come through and seize their land through eminent domain. Corporations have so much power that has mobilized a lot of suburban women to fight back. That and the horror show that is Donald Trump.
Really curious. There was a film that came out over the summer. I only learned about it recently. Credit where credit is due to Congresswoman Madeleine Dean flagged it for me and for others. It's called Irresistible. It has Steve Carell and other A-list actors, and was actually written and directed by Jon Stewart. But anyhow, it's set in Wisconsin. Democratic operatives come in and they say to the townsfolk, I'm not going to give it away, but they say, we just can't talk to you. And we don't know how to engage and talk to you. And so much of the reporting over the last year or less of the 2020 cycle, it's folks from what you're referring to as the bubble. Essentially, this is my editorializing, but they just change up proper nouns. They go to rural Wisconsin, rural Pennsylvania, rural Michigan. You know, the town name changes, the profile piece changes. You got a different secret sauce, and I don't know if you're willing to share it.
I mean, yeah. So you mentioned that Hilton Garden Inn, okay? That Hilton Garden Inn in South Point that I spent 7 years in, like hating myself, worried that I was working on the wrong story, and eating those free cookies they have at night, okay?
I just want to, I remember those cookies so well. My wife and I, we had a fire at our house, and that's where Liberty Mutual put us up for 91 nights. So we learned all about those damn cookies. They were good for, you know, 4 days, and they're so tempting.
That hotel, I have to say, it was like an oasis for me and the Brussels sprouts. But we'll move back to the subject at hand, which is suddenly in the Connor Lamb race, there is CNN shooting and like reporting live from the Hilton Garden Inn in South Point. You know, I think the secret sauce would be one thing, which is time. You know, I can't write about something unless I think I've really engaged in it deeply. And I wanted to return to the fracking for a minute because, you know, reasonable people disagree about whether fracking is part of the common good or not. And what happens often in rural places is here are people who have much more sophisticated understandings of their mineral rights than city folk, right? They got nothing for their coal. They're still coal mining happening under their farms. If industrial coal mining called longwall mining comes under their farm, by definition, they are going to lose their water. By definition. So many of them signed these oil and gas leases to try to protect themselves against coal mining. And that makes them feel different ways. Also, they're making money for the first time off their mineral rights, which have been ripped off from them for 150 years. Now, I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest not only that fracking is harmful, but that it's basically unnecessary, to be really honest. I mean, where we look at the energy market growing fastest is in renewables. So I think the interest in perpetuating fracking really comes from Wall Street because of how you churn money. And I'd refer you to Bethany's work there. But people who experience it have very different understandings of how it works. People who experience it firsthand. That, even that level of being able to write about it, you couldn't drop into a farm and get that in a day or a week or maybe even a year. You'd have to be there for long enough to watch the wells, to watch the frack teams leave, you know, to watch the crews come and go. And I don't know, I'm not interested in feeding the divide. You know, a lot of what I do is report on religion. And if all I'm going to do is like call up a bunch of people for their sound bites, what is the point of that? You know, I do this to try to understand things. And I'm really freaking lucky that the people I work for, because it's also a matter of money, right? That they're willing to invest in that. Like one of the things that makes it different is like, I don't have to do it in 24 hours. You know, I can do it in 2 months, sake of my own pocketbook, but who cares, you know?
Well, that's the hope of this podcast. You know, I don't think our listeners are looking for affirmation. They're looking for information. And there's still a lot of questions about as the dust settles from the 2020 cycle. Let me ask you, I mean, it seems like a decade ago, but pre-pandemic, it's January 2020, pre-Iowa caucuses, you know, field of more people than we can count with two hands. Was this the lens through which you were looking, the suburban women or the rural America and the energy industry? Or
because I had been in Pennsylvania looking at these issues since 2011, sort of, but since 2013, hardcore. And because I am interested in how ideology takes practical roots, these were the very divides that I was interested in how they play out. And I'll just say, I do not think, and this is as a Pennsylvania girl, but I do not think there's a more interesting place to be a reporter or a political analyst for that matter, because people in Pennsylvania say what they think. You know, they're not, you're not going to hit a kind of New York City soft peddling of, they're going to say what they think. And they come in contact with people who are different than they are, because geographically, that's the reality. And in so much of this country, that's not true. People soft pedal what they think, and they live among people just like them. And they never, you can't go downtown in Philadelphia and not hit within a 10-minute drive a Trump supporter and a Black Lives Matter protester living next to each other. I don't know if that's unique. It feels pretty unique, and it feels very exciting as a reporter, because these stories are the ways we look at deeper truths. And Pennsylvania seems like the best place I know to do that.
Hey, I'm biased. You're preaching to the choir with me and our listeners. I don't know if it's unique, but I think a great tradition that Pennsylvania has, unfortunately, this past summer, it didn't, but is county fairs. You know, from my hometown of Allentown, this goes back to before the Civil War, all sorts of folklore that's happened on those grounds. I know this, I mean, they're already planning. They're super excited that they got Toby Keith and Carrie Underwood coming to the fair, but you must have had some time at the county fair out there in Washington County. I've never been to the Washington County Fair. I did judge a goat beauty contest at the Lawrence County Fair one summer. It's a long story, but what is it about county fairs and other kind of unique Pennsylvania iconic that as we wind down that, you know, really stands out, that makes it such a unique place, even as we're in the 21st century?
So my book begins and ends in the Washington County Fair. And I went every year that I reported that book, because there is nothing like it on the face of the planet. And one of the tensions that we have seen emerging is that, like, the corporatization of those fairs, right? That the oil and gas companies are all over trying to not only brand the fairs, but they're also buying up the livestock of the kids, you know, at auction. And that's complicated. That is complicated. So I watched that happening firsthand over, you know, 7 years. But I also watched, you know, in the family, the Haney family, who I spend so much time with, the Pat Haney is a butternut growing extraordinaire. And he got the blue ribbon in the butternuts every year. There was a Lego gas well one year that won first place in construction. Stacy's sister, who I write mostly about Stacy, her sister Shelly, keeps wild bees. She always is winning prizes for her honey. Between that, the smell of fudge, the smell of popcorn, the mud, watching Winston Churchill, the goat, be groomed outside a trailer with a blow dryer and a comb, like, more attention to his hair than I've ever given to mine. You know, I think it speaks so much to what we're talking about, because it's both real and idealized, right? It's, the fair is actually happening. And yet here is a story people are telling themselves about how land and animals still work, which is much more layered than, you know, a blue gingham bonnet. And I think that's why it's such a fun lens to look through. Also, it's just damn fun to go to the county fair.
I think this summer we're going to have to devote a whole episode or series of episodes going around to county fairs. But you've been super, super generous with your time. One, actually two more final questions. The first, you know, we have a lot of student listeners. How does one get into a career in journalism? I mean, journalism's changed so much over the last two decades.
I never thought of going to graduate school for journalism. And now I'm a professor at NYU in the journalism program. And, you know, not just because of where I sit, I think a year-long graduate journalism program is worth it these days, because you get certain skills that didn't used to be so necessary. And it's also a really good introduction to the job market. But 80% of doing the work is just getting yourself there, right? So I think that really sets people's work apart. So whether you want to be a foreign correspondent and you go live in Istanbul, like the farther out you go, it's cheap in most of the world. You know, you will have a small number of contacts and you'll get exposure on the ground, and that will give you a good sense whether it is Washington County. I mean, we desperately, desperately need rural reporting in America. You know, that local reporting, it's the loss of it has hobbled us in so many fundamental ways. So get out, intern for your local paper, you know, take graduate journalism courses, maybe don't even enroll in a program. Try one class, try one virtual class for a semester and see how it goes and see if you feel like you're learning skills there that are practical and applicable.
So final question, if I dare, you know, folks are already talking about 2022. Pennsylvania is going to be ground zero. Dare I say the Keystone State, open governor's mansion, open Senate seat. You know, to the extent you're comfortable, what's the lens that you're going to be looking through over the coming months of the primary and then into a general?
Well, I mean, I'm looking within the Democratic race among the candidates for Senate, right? I think that's a super interesting place to look because there are so many big names and seasoned politicians who are throwing their hat in. You know, and that's been surprising. I think that's unusual that, like, first of all, there's already national coverage, but there's also name recognition on a national level for who might be the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate from Pennsylvania. And that's really interesting. And on the Republican side, I think the question is, you know, we have seen Trumpism defeated not only on a national level, we've seen it fail when people try to tout it in the past, in 2018, in the midterms, right? We didn't see a lot of success in Pennsylvania with like being mini Trumps. Now, however, I don't know. You know, we are looking at more than 100 million Americans who believe that there was some kind of electoral fraud. Will they be able to claim some sort of martyrdom rule or some sort of like clean government in an alternate universe? And will that gain them supporters? So that's what I'm interested in, the fracturing of the right and the future of Trumpism within it, you know, of disinformation, we could say. And on the left, what's going to be the thing? Is it about being in the center that's going to make popular candidates? Are we going to see more, you know, you got to have your progressive bona fides to get those endorsements? I don't know. That's sort of what I'm looking at.
Well, I look forward to reading whatever you have in store. And I know our listeners look forward to reading and hopefully bumping into you post-pandemic as the campaign trail bobs and weaves and winds its way through the hills and hollers of Southwest PA all the way through the Philadelphia suburbs. But thanks again.
Ari, thank you. And thank you so much for your careful work. I mean, it makes journalism so much better to be able to call and figure out what's afoot with people who spend their lives watching it. So thank you.
You bet.
Thank you all so much for listening to today's episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. As Hillary Clinton used to say, it takes a village. This podcast would not be possible without the help of Sarah McGrath and Jake Schwartz. If you liked this discussion, we would love for you to give us a review, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a suggestion on a future guest and other feedback, visit our website, papoliticspodcast.org. Don't forget to follow us on social media at PA Political Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn.